Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, welcome to Film Fandango, the film podcast. My name is David Reed, and with me, as ever, is Mr. Marek Larwood. Hello, Marek.
Hello, David.
How are we this week?
The usual.
The usual. So, pit of despair?
I don't think I'm that. Maybe I am. It's always good to see, think the worst. I've said this before, because then you're pleasantly surprised.
It's an interesting theory. Yeah, I haven't tried it myself.
It's working in this industry because the worst. I basically working in the media, which is an industry full of liars who want to say the good things to you purely for their own egos, that you just start mistrusting everyone and thinking nothing's going to happen. And normally, what happens?
Yeah, yeah.
And people think it's a self perpetuating myth that you've got negative thoughts lead to negative thoughts. These people are idiots. As you get older, you realise that, you know, you just become wiser. And maybe that is that wiseness can be mistaken for bitterness, but it is not bitterness, it is wise.
Is this
wisdom?
Is this wisdom?
Not wiseness.
It's wiseness. Is this wisdom leading to more work?
It's just being very wary.
Okay.
Who do you want to follow through the minefield? The guy just running out there with his hands, waving his hands everywhere, skipping.
The guy with the optimistic atmosphere. Attitude. Yeah.
Or do you want to follow the careful person who is taking step by step and always thinking they might potentially be blown up at any moment?
Yeah. Well, the second guy.
The
second guy.
Well, you're right.
Yeah.
We're not here to talk about
minefields
or nervous breakdowns. We're here to talk about films.
Films. Now, it's a strange time at the cinema at the moment. It feels like it's all slowed down a bit for me.
I don't understand the weird periods of the year why all the good films are around the Oscar time.
Stacked in. Well,
why are they? I know it's winter.
Because the hype leaks through to the Academy. Voting panel.
But why are they all released? Because if these films, they go to all the Cannes, all the festivals.
Yeah.
And then the production companies decide, or the distribution companies decide when they're going to be released. Why do they always release them? I know in the winter some people are going to cinema, but April bank holiday, May bank holiday, the May bank holiday is normally rainy. Lots of people go to cinema. Why aren't there films all year round? Where have we got this weird summer glut?
I don't know. I can't answer that. They always stick big blockbusters in there, and then things don't go up against them. That seems to be the...
Well, I don't understand it.
It must be numbers. I mean, they'll have just looked at sales figures and gone, these sorts of films don't do well at this time of year, let's never do that again. And then if word gets around, it becomes religion, doesn't it? It becomes magic.
Yeah.
I don't know, but you have seen a film in the cinema.
Yes, I went. This is a film I'm going to talk about. I saw just over a week ago. When I went on a bank holiday.
Okay.
Which is always a not very nice idea.
Well, is it a bit more crowded? A bit more.
Yeah, I'm so lucky that because I as well as not being poor, but I do get to working unconventional times. You get to go to cinema during the day.
Yes.
Which is one of the greatest things.
Well, I, for the first time in a long time this morning, had to go in to work early, so I had to get the rush hour tube.
Yeah, horrible.
I don't understand how most people aren't just ill all the time. I mean, you're crammed into a hot, sweaty space with these, you know, coughing people.
Yeah.
I mean, no wonder they go to the gym so often, Merrick, and drink all of these kale shakes and
there's
things.
There's too many people. Did it for about 8 years. Terrible. I went to go and see Far From the Madding Crowd. We're talking about Rush Hour. Far From the Madding Crowd seems quite crowd. Apt. One of my local cinemas, the Muswell Hill Odeon, as usual, is something wrong.
Yeah, what was wrong this time?
Well, they've got three screens.
Yeah.
So they've got the one huge, beautiful, huge, big screen.
Screen one.
Yeah, and then they've got the two downstairs.
Screens two and three.
Two and three, with a wall in there.
With bleed through.
The bleed, there's a kids film next door, I don't know what it was singing, and Far From Manning Crowd's quite a quiet
guess would be the SpongeBob SquarePants movie.
No, I think it's something, another kids film. The bleed was really bad. Really, for the first
was it
half
that
an hour.
Purple animated alien one. Dinosaur thing. Yeah.
It was it's unacceptable to have that bleed in a cinema.
Yeah, it is.
It's just simply unacceptable.
Well, it is. I think it's, you are paying for an experience. That's what the cinema is supposed to be. We've said it before. And, you know, they need to control that experience. That you're not paying them to just press play on their projector. That's not what you're paying
for. Yeah, that needs to be, you needs to be a properly soundproof, soundproof wall. Maybe you're losing, that cinema's never full. Even if you lose one column of seats, one seat off there, you soundproof that wall.
So like we've no soundproofed bleed. This wall,
like
so
this,
there's
like
never any bleed of
here.
Traffic or sirens.
We're
providing a service.
There should be someone who actually gives the cinemas, you know, when you go to food hygiene you go to restaurants and they've got the food hygiene thing
certificate. Yeah,
yeah. And outside, some it's only out of five, and some of them occasionally they put a certificate in the front of their door and it says food hygiene 4. And you think, well, what? Why would you put that stuff?
There was only one turd in the fryer, and that was it. So we're very proud of that.
I find that worrying. They should say, this screen is a, they should be not able to charge as much. They put up, it was like 11 quid for
You're saying like a Michelin star system for cinema experiences. Yeah. We should start that, the Film Fandango ratings.
Yeah.
And then people, if they can see an actual return in sales from it, then,
But Muswell Hill has been bought, apparently, by the Everyman Group.
They're all right.
The audience, it should be better.
Then, I don't know how many cinemas you can own and still be called independent, but...
Yeah.
You know.
Anyway, let's talk about the film. That's me, Murray. But as usual, on a bank holiday, Far From Manning Crowd, there are lots of women in their 50s.
And you.
And me. And there was... I could see... People, I wasn't on the receiving end of this, of the gossiping. Again, there was a case of someone gossiping all the way through to the start of the first person talking. I could see this woman's head in the distance. She had white hair in the cinema, and her head just talking constantly for half an hour. And the people behind, I could see, by the way, because the Muswell Hill cinema is not, it wasn't completely dark.
Yeah.
I could see the faces of the people behind getting increasingly more pissed off.
But they don't say anything, do they? I
mean, no, but it was just literally someone just talk. They looked like they were talking, and it always seems to be in Crouch End, it must have been this particular type of, the educated, rich, well-off people, and they behave like arseholes. Anyway.
But she shut up as soon as the characters start talking.
Yeah, literally, we'll start as soon as it gets
Good enough. Yeah. Not good enough. So, Far From the Madding Crowd.
Okay.
What is it about for people who do not know?
Well, it's based on a Tom Hardy novel. It was a famous novel.
Not the actor Tom Hardy, of course.
No, Thomas Hardy.
Yes.
I did an English degree and I had to try and read Tess of D'Urbervilles and Far From the Madding Crowd.
Yeah.
I gave up on Thomas Hardy and I've tried to read him a couple of times because I found it so monumentally dull.
He was an apprentice architect before he was a writer.
Okay.
And one of his jobs was to clear out the graves in St Pancras Churchyard for the building of the new Victorian Railway that would go to St Pancras. And so he had to exhume all of the graves. And to honour the dead, he created what is now called the Hardy Tree, which is still in St Pancras Churchyard for you to see, which is an incredible Tim Burton-esque... spiral of tombstones with a tree growing out of them that's
Oh, really?
Become one thing. It's an amazing little thing.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, little bit of local knowledge. So that's about what, 200-300 yards from here.
Oh, and have you ridden the Thomas Hardy?
I think I may have read Tess of the D'Urbervilles, but a long time ago.
Yeah, I'd give up. If I don't find a book interesting the first 70 pages, I give up.
That's the cut-off.
Yeah, I started trying to read all the classics. And
some of classics for a very good reason. Yeah, and then some you just go, this is, oh,
things like slow. The Woman in White I really loved, you know.
Gulliver's Travels I thought was great.
But a lot of them, I just think, I can see where how you change the... This changed the course of literature, but if I'm really honest with myself, I'm not enjoying this. Some Maddox Ford book of it was boring. Or James Joyce. I was talking to a friend about James Joyce.
Oh,
tedious.
Yeah, I've read Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man and Dubliners, and bought Ulysses. I was just like, no, I can't.
I don't understand.
It's more academically interesting than actually enjoyable to anyway. But far from the Mad and Crown, what's the plot?
Right, so it's a story of Bathsheba Everdeen, who is a governess working on a farm, and she gets left this farm by her uncle. At the start of it, she's working on a farm, and Gabriel Oak, the farmer from adjoining farm, who is just a really nice, good man. Not too much personality. An honest, decent man would make a good husband.
Yeah,
he proposes to her,
Mr. Oak.
She's too independent, and she wants to go off and do her own thing. But he loses all his flock of sheep and becomes poor. She inherits a farm and takes control of a farm, and it's just a story of her running the farm, which Mr. Oak goes to work for her.
Oh no, after they used to be more equals.
Yeah, and then the next, there's a rich neighbour played by, what's his name, who's in everything, Michael Sheen.
Mm-hmm.
Who's a bit of a cold man who hasn't really got much emotion, but he falls in love with Kerry Mulligan.
Bathsheba Everdeen.
And then there is
a hell of a name.
And then there's a soldier who's quite... charismatic at the start.
So it's
Sergeant Francis Troy.
It's a love story about these three men who love me. Is that the?
It's pretty much it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems
a love square.
A love square with a strong female lead.
Corner.
Now, Kerry Mulligan.
Hello.
I don't know. I'm still unconvinced whether she annoys me or not.
Okay. I haven't seen an Education, which is the one that made her, isn't it? I still haven't seen that.
It's all right. Yeah.
I've seen Shame. I've seen Drive.
And Drive are brilliant films.
I've seen that one with Keira Knightley and Andrew Garfield, where they're clones.
The novel one. That
spoilers.
Yeah.
Which the name of which I can never remember. She is very charismatic.
Never Let Me Go.
Never Let Me Go. Yeah. She's very charismatic.
Inside Llewyn Davis, she's in as well. Here's my problem with her.
Yeah.
She does this look, and a lot of this is in, you know, every single period drama, every single one, there's always that scene when they're in church.
Yeah.
The female character is reading her book and looks coyly upwards.
Yes.
In the opposing aisle, the male character
slightly further forward, so he has to look back to see
or,
her.
Yeah, somewhat. Always the opposing aisle. There's either one or two male characters, and they do the look. They look down, and they sort of. She does this coy smile. I want to do a Kerry Mulligan. Is that the right coy smile? That sort of coy smile count per film. I think that's Dave's doing it now. It's to describe it to you. It's a look sort of into the distance. A look down, a sort of half smile, sort of semi-flirtatious smile to yourself, and look up. That is the Kerry Mulligan look, which she's almost doing in 90% of every single scene she's
Mulliganing.
Mulligan. We talked about it before. I think there's at least, if you watched the Kerry Mulligan films back to back, I think you'd find it really, you'd be exposed.
I think she's done enough movies for a supercut now of Mulliganing.
Just the Mulligan. Look down, look. The but look it's... down, smile to yourself, look up. A Mulligan.
But if it works, I mean...
It works, but people are starting to catch on to the... I've spoken to a couple of people about this mulliganing. People are starting to catch on to it.
I think you'd be fine with the mulliganing if she was bringing more to the table. I'm getting the sense you think she's only got one weapon in her arsenal.
She's a good actress. But this film, a lot of it, with these period dramas, it's just, you know, Carey Mulligan walks up to this farmer. Mr. Oak, how are your, I don't know, sheep looking well today? A look. He just looks at her. If you had a conversation like that in real life, it wouldn't be, in these romantic dramas, there's music playing underneath and it's sort of, it's the atmosphere is pregnant with flirtation. Yeah, yeah. In real life, have a conversation with someone.
Awkward.
Yeah, it'd be this. Mr. Reed, you've pigs are looking quite muddy.
Yeah, they tend to.
Well, I shall be seeing you, Mr. Reed.
Yes, likewise.
And that is probably... So that is a typical scene in this thing.
I thought that was wonderful, by the way. I mean, that, we should write that up.
I have slowly fallen in love with you. But it's just that, but more... A lot of looking into the distance and a lot of...
It's Ted and Ralph, isn't it? It's the Fast Show, I think, found it beautifully. It's exactly Ted and Ralph.
So you feel like you know exactly what's going to happen. You see, you know, the bad... The soldiers is... But I went for a really bad piss in this film. Not a really bad...
What do you mean by bad?
As in timing-wise.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I didn't... It wasn't like, oh, God, it's going...
Yeah, that's what I was picturing.
It's going everywhere! I went, literally, at probably the worst minute and a half, 2 minutes, and I took with the film, where...
The one thing happens.
Well, Kerry, I think because the book is so big, I remember seeing Five Man Crown, I think it's, I don't know how many pages it is. I'm sure it's about, because I tried about 400 pages. So it does feel as though they're packing in a lot, condensing it a lot to try and get it in. So there's some of the actions aren't believable because they realise they've got to cover this huge book where there could be about two or three films. She pretty much got married and fell in love in this 2 minutes. I went to the loo. So I'm with a soldier, with a bad soldier bloke. Sorry, spoilers.
So they were flirting by the pigs. You go for a bad piss. And when you come back, she's got children.
No,
and
it was just
having a divorce.
It was just something. I really missed something important. Thing. I was really annoyed. I know someone sent me a link to a good time to go for a wee in a film.
I went for a bad piss during Prometheus as well.
Oh, did you? When was that? Yeah.
When they're dissecting the alien head. And does it explode or something? I missed all of that. Didn't know what had happened.
You almost need something. You know when the adverts are going to come on TV, they used to have that thing flashing in the corner.
They still do, yeah. It depends on your telly.
TV's
you know what that
too
is?
Small to the...
You know why that's there?
Why?
It's to tell the broadcasters that we're coming up to an advert break. And it used to be hidden because TVs used to have curved corners. So the TVs at home wouldn't see it. But nowadays, because we have proper square ones...
I think because my TV is so rubbish, I can't... I don't see it anymore.
Okay.
They should just have, just in the corner, a piss dot. Okay, if you need to go halfway through, here is it.
If you want to avoid bad pissing, then go now. I think that's a good service. I mean, I would be interested in our listeners' worst bad pisses... personally, if they would like to tell us what was the baddest piss that you went for during a film and missed the most important details, then you can email us, dearfilmfandango@gmail.com.
If the film weren't so long, if there weren't so many, they got rid of the adverts at the start, or I want to get in early on the bank holiday because I like sitting in the back.
Yeah.
And I wanted to sit there and look menacing so I had my space. I didn't want to get a rubbish seat, basically. Yeah.
You know what would be menacing, though? Catheter. Just
on the seat next to me.
The bag on the seat next to you.
Yeah.
Although you run the risk of someone not noticing and then sitting down hard on it, and setting it all back up.
That would be a bad. Oh, right. Oh my God. Anyway, I'll just go back to the film. So, Matthias Schoenaerts, who you might recognise from Rust and Bone as the.
Yeah, he was very good in Rust and Bone. I've seen the trailer.
Bullhead as well.
His English accent's very good.
Occasionally it's a bit off.
Is it?
He's very good. I mean, he's obviously this handsome...
Street fighter.
Yeah. There's too many spoilers in it, but you just think he was good at it, but he's just playing clearly the female love interest.
Yeah.
Because he got really that much of a... looking into distance a bit much. And he can act really well, I think. Maybe he's not given the opportunity to.
But that's not for you, is it? I mean,
It's not really my film. It's a perfectly fine Sunday afternoon drama that's not a spectacular period drama. It's just a steady period drama.
What is, in your opinion? Are you a fan of the genre of period drama? Because what you've described in The Mulliganing isn't necessarily a new thing. I mean, it's all like that, isn't it? The Jane Austen-ing of it.
It just felt the same. It felt like the same. I hate those looks because it just seems so fake. That's looking into the distance, and just the whole way of doing it. There's nothing. It just feels quite laboured to me. And I don't find it particularly interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, as we've probably established in this podcast, I'm a bit of an arsehole, so that's probably why.
No, don't do that to yourself.
It was all right. I give it six.
Six Marics. Well, far from the madding crowd. There we go.
Guess what?
What?
People have written in.
What do they want, these people?
They all want...
Why do they keep hounding us?
They all want different things.
Okay, what does the first one want?
Alright then. Here
is that your idea of filling?
Here it is. He says, can you do this? It's from Alan Russell. He's asked for an Argentinian accent.
Argentina... I don't know if that is Argentinian at all, actually.
Mexican being.
He's a Mexican accent. Dear David Maragamburi, on your recommendation, I tracked down Wild Tales. Absolutely brilliant. I loved all six stories, but the highlight for me was the fight scene after the car breakdown. Witty, beautifully shot, and surprising twists in each of the tales. My question to you is this. What are your favourite short movies? My choice is a bit of a fraud. I think of each act in the Kill Bill movies as a short story, and would select the demise of Bud, Michael Madsen's character, as my favourite. If I'm not cheating, do the Wallace and Gromit films count as shorts? Keep watching the films, Alan.
Well, yes, Wild Tales. I watched it a number of weeks ago. It's excellent, and I would agree. I would agree with Alan. It's the fight in the car breakdown short film in that is such a highlight.
It's great.
I heartily recommend it. Argentinian six short stories about revenge. Favorite short films.
I could say Pulp Fiction's the same thing, really, isn't it? It's
like a portmanteau, really, but it's not quite. But short stories within another story or whatever. Is he asking actually? Short stories within a feature film, or actually just short films?
Yeah, I don't really. I can't. I just think of things I've seen on Vimeo that I've quite enjoyed.
Yeah, and I do too. But then they tend to be quite transient. You sort of go, "That was good. I won't watch it again." You know what I mean? There's so many short films out there. None actually spring to mind. I'm trying to think of anthology feature films though that like Wild Tales. And I'm failing to do so. So that's
everyone can send in their own short films.
If you have any particular favourite short films, or if you've made one even and want to share it with the listeners, then send it to us.
Well, here's an email from Christine at Short Film Sunday, who's a big supporter of our podcast, and they post. If you look up Short Film Sunday on the internet, they post short films every week. You can that they pick out, which are really, really good.
Perfect.
Shall I read this one out?
Yes.
Okay. Hi guys, I'm reading this voice.
It's a good voice.
Hi guys, hope you're well. I really enjoyed Eric's questions, which is the guy from we did a couple of weeks ago. Anyway, the music question was tough. What was the music question about? What are the best songs from?
I think it was jukebox songs, as in songs that in movies that are actual songs rather than for. Soundtrack. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Not score, as in songs.
Yeah. The music question was tough. There are some famous instances like I Would Always Love You, written for the stage show. of Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, but used in The Bodyguard.
Yes.
Or Peter Gabriel's In Your Eyes, used in Say Anything. Neither of those are my favourite, but I would say there's a stretch of John Cusack films where the soundtracks are terrific collections of music. There's tons of Seattle bands used for Say Anything, and Gross Point Blank makes fantastic use of music with Minnie Driver's character being a DJ. Joe Strummer composed the score, but they are used Rudy Can't Fail. And High Fidelity takes full advantage of the playlist format, Hard to Beat the Beta Band moment with Dry the Rain. Those both are both still soundtracks I listen to, with great mix of classics and some guilty pleasures. My other moment might be Hotline by the Silvers in Miguel Arteta's Cedar Rapids. It's a terrific little indie film, and I was happy to hear an old disco song that hadn't been used in 100 other films. Hope to hear some others too. Thanks, Christy. Super. So there's some film soundtrack things.
Yeah, I used to have the Gross Point Blank soundtrack as well. It's interesting that, isn't it, where they justify the soundtrack through the story or, you know, the character in it.
Mm.
Radio is a common one, you know. The number of films that start with a radio playing so they can put a pop song just to inject energy right up top.
I think Groundhog Day is a great start to the...
What's the song that keeps playing?
It's... I know what it is. I can't remember.
Is it I've Got You, Babe?
Yes.
Yeah.
Here's an email. It's from Tim Walker.
What accent does he want?
Doesn't say.
Dear David and Marek, thanks again for a great podcast last week. I will definitely look out for Wild Tales after your entertaining review. I wanted to quickly write in, it's a long email, it's not that quick, about the subject of trailers, which isn't something you've covered recently, but I feel some of the latest trailers are ruining the film experience. This week, Universal Pictures released an extended version of a trailer for Jurassic World, and I watched it alongside the latest teaser trailer for J.J. Abrams for his upcoming Star Wars film. These are two films that I've been looking forward to ever since I heard about their production, but I am now in a very different position because my interest in one of the films has massively increased, and my interest in the other film has vanished to nothing, and all because of their trailers. The Jurassic World trailer made me feel as if I had seen the entire film as a 3-minute short, and maybe leaving out a few of the money shots.
Okay. There's no definition of money shots.
Yeah, I think he's using it metaphorically. I hope
to see Tyrannosaurus Rex go off.
Other than those, I got the whole film. It's about a bunch of lead actors shouting run to a large group of extras, and then all the actors performing shock reactions to what we all know is a green screen and probably empty space in a studio somewhere. No one believes in CGI monsters anymore. And I am just bored of the whole scientists dabbling in things they shouldn't be dabbling in type of script. Spoiler alert! The scientists create a new mega dinosaur. It escapes. It destroys the island. They find a way to kill it. I was excited about Jurassic World because I thought it would take the idea of dinosaurs among people to a new level. It doesn't. It's essentially a tired repeat of Jurassic Park with far less interesting actors and with what seems to be no original ideas at all. I won't be watching Jurassic World after all, and it's all due to the trailer. It simply shows too much. In contrast, the Star Wars trailer is a genuine tease, and the trailer shows just enough to make me really want for more. J.J. Abrams is excellent at spinning out a mystery, and he definitely doesn't want to give anything away in this trailer, which makes the film much more attractive. I will be pre-ordering my tickets for Star Wars as soon as they let me. I can never make up my mind about the usefulness of trailers. On the one hand, they're a great bit of foreplay, but on the other hand, they can ruin a decent film experience, because you learn too much. I would love to hear about your favourite or worst trailer experiences. My worst is Prometheus. The trailer was stunning and mystifying. In extreme contrast, the film was such a confused mixture of awfulness that when everyone left the cinema, I still remember the stunned, embarrassed silence as we all shuffled out. That's it. Love the podcast and keep watching the films. Much love, Tim Walker.
Thank you, Tim. Yes, I'm in total agreement with all three of your points there. I thought Jurassic World... I wasn't that excited by another Jurassic Park sequel, but I had an open mind, and the trailer does make it look duff. Star Wars, they've been very cool about just
sneaking. I don't really like
sneaking.
Star Wars.
Love Star Wars.
But they've made it look
awesome.
Yeah.
It does look awesome.
They perfected the art of just leaving it to your imagination.
Well, into the CGI conversation there as well. I can't remember if I talked about this on the podcast before, but I've heard a story that Simon Pegg showed his daughter The Empire Strikes Back for the first time. And Simon Pegg is a good friend of J.J. Abrams from being Scotty in the Star Trek films. He's writing Star Trek 3. And he showed his daughter this film. And she'd seen the prequels, the more modern ones, but not the originals. And for the first time, she turned to her dad and went, "Daddy, Yoda's real." And she was amazed because he's a puppet, not a CGI thing.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
This was a, you know, this is a young kid who's been brought up with CGI. It's always existed. And she was charmed by the puppet. Simon Pegg told J.J. Abrams this, and he took note, and he's done as much practical effects in the new Star Wars film as possible. Mm. So the robot is real. It's an incredible robot that is a sphere with a head. The head just stays on the top of the sphere, and it's...
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And they've done as many practical sets and all of this, and proper prosthetic makeup and puppets and all the rest, because that's what a Star Wars film is. Mm. And so I am genuinely looking forward to it. I think it might be very good.
Do you think they'll ever remake all the prequels because they're so shit?
I mean, by and large, I think if you failed, just leave it behind. And if you succeeded, leave it alone. But who knows? I mean, Star Wars, I don't think they can, because George Lucas is a god to those people. So I don't think they can say he screwed up. I think they'll just have to move forward, frankly.
Okay.
Worst trailer experiences. Prometheus, again, I totally
agree.
I agree
with Prometheus.
It was such an exciting trailer, and then the film was trousers.
Yeah.
Utter trousers. Space trousers, in fact.
Probably the other good ones that ruin it, a lot of them ruin it. The best trailer, I remember watching the Seven trailer years and years ago. I think I've got to go and see that film. The trailer was amazing.
Yeah.
And the film was just as good. A lot of time with bad trailers, I don't go and see the film.
Yeah. I remember one I particularly liked when I was younger was the trailer for Trainspotting, because it was nothing to do with the film.
Yeah.
But it was so intriguing because it was nothing like anything you'd seen before.
It was Briggs.
They were tying him to the railroad tracks, and he was speaking directly into camera.
He
was saying, "Do this in life, don't do that, and whatever you do, don't let your friends tie you to the railway tracks." And we're just like, that sounds exciting, and is a situation of jeopardy that is nothing to do with the film whatsoever.
Yeah.
But it got you hooked. And then they had the, Born Slippy or whatever it was.
Underworld.
Yeah, yeah. Dun, 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 and some shots from the movie, but you didn't know what it was. No, they can really ruin a film experience, especially in something with a slight story. If something's got a fairly off-the-peg story and it's the journey and the characters that are exciting, it just turns you off it. And we've said it before, the comedies, I think, suffer the most from this, because you can watch a good story again and again and again, knowing what's going to happen because the journey is exciting. With jokes, they will never have the same impact as the first time you heard them. And in comedy trailers, they put their best jokes in it, so the film is always underwhelming, because you go and you just, "Huh, yeah, that one again, I've heard that."
I wonder how important trailers are. I think people go to cinema through word of mouth. I don't know how much good it does them. I'm really intrigued.
I think people talk about stuff after they get excited by the trailers, and I think they do work. But I personally, I think if, you know, you're a blockbuster, you can afford to put money aside in the budget to throw curveballs at people and get them excited with scenes that aren't in the film, and just so that the actual experience of the story is fresh.
Yeah.
That's mine.
I'll do a couple more quick emails.
Yeah.
From Fran Jolly. He hasn't specified an accent. After all the Avengers move, he hasn't written, he missed out the I in movies, but
move.
I'll leave it out. After all the Avengers move last week, yeah, it's not bad once you get past CGI bashing and plot holes. But which book stroke comics do you think would make a decent silver screen adaptation? I'm surprised Roald Dahl's The Twits and George's Marvellous Medicine haven't been made into movies, as though my favourite children's books. I think you would enjoy Kevin Pollak's documentary Misery Loves Comedy. He talks to pretty much all the biggest stand-ups in modern history, and Freddie Prinze Jr. is available on iTunes. I loved Going Clear and Punk Syndrome, by the way. Keep on podding. Thanks, Fran.
We will keep on podding.
What do you think are the best... what books should be made into the silver screen?
Particular favourites of mine are George MacDonald Fraser's Flashman novels, which were made into a film long time ago with Malcolm McDowell, I believe, in the lead role, and it's not great. But it's his character is this absolute rakish cad who everyone believes is the archetypical British colonial hero, but he's an absolute coward and a shit, and he's just there at every historical event, and he always comes out on top. He's the total anti-hero, and they're very, very funny and entertaining. But I think they would make absolutely brilliant films. But apart from that, I don't know. What do you reckon?
I think The Twits is quite a good call. What do I like? I like the comic books. Is it Art Spiegelman's Mouse, that a famous one?
Yeah. That'd be hard to do. I mean, animation, it would have to be.
Yeah, be animation, but I think that'd be really good. It'd be really interesting.
Mouse is brilliant.
Yeah, so I'd really like to see that. I'm trying to think.
I'm looking over at my my bookshelf.
My brother's book, Freaks.
Yeah?
Would be a brilliant film.
It would be
film.
The biggest film of all time, wouldn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, it's by Kieran Larwood. It's called Freaks. It's about a Victorian... a group of freak show that become detectives by night. Someone should buy that and make it into a Plymouth film.
Yeah.
Should I go on to the next email?
Sure.
We'll just do one more, then we'll talk about the next film.
Sure thing.
This is from Lee Wood. He's Welsh.
Lee Wood. Hi, guys. I'm Welsh.
This is Rod Gilbert.
Rod Gilbert. I recently watched John Wick, and I thought it was great, but I was disappointed that it has already had a sequel announced. You could see that they were building to it with some scenes in the hotel, but it seems like every film today has to be a franchise and can't stand on its own. Taken and The Hangover really didn't need three films. Do you ever get disappointed when you hear a film has a sequel? Matrix sequels really burnt me. What films do you really hate there was a sequel for, and what films deserved a sequel but did not get one? Thanks, Lee. Sent from my iPhone.
John Wick, yeah, it's been getting good reviews.
It, yeah.
Like to see it, and Keanu Reeves is, you know, he's been quiet for a while, hasn't he?
Yeah, because he turned down a film, is that story, isn't it? He turned down... Or Speed Fit. So I don't know exactly what it is, so I'm just... This is just
a
rubbish story. Apparently he turned down some film when he pissed off the main... Like 20th Century or one.
Oh, really?
Because he didn't really work as much.
I think he's a very watchable leading man. I think he's good. We'll check out John Wick. But, yeah, when they obviously set up sequels, it feels a bit cheap to me. It feels like begging. You know, you deserve your sequel if you've rounded off a really good film well, you know, then a sequel can happen. You don't need to go, oh, the next case looks even more intriguing, because that's a bad end to a film.
Yeah.
Unless you're setting up, you know, a trilogy of films or a duo of films where, you know, you've got a larger story to tell. But when it's just, this story has finished, let it finish, and we'll want more.
Yeah.
You know, we will... That is basically, you know, what I think. I mean, sequels is a tricky one, because if they've created a really good character and a really good world they inhabit, then, yeah, give us more. Fine. Not everything has to be a trilogy. You don't have to have an over-arc that's going through
that's
it.
I think I'm
a big fan of the original, you know, Indiana Jones films that are all standalone stories, or Lethal Weapon that are all standalone stories, or whatever. You know, whatever works for you, but it's when they just follow market forces to go, trilogies are in, or you're just like, what are you doing?
I wish, the first film I brought in to Film Fandango when I was a guest, many years ago now.
It was a long time ago.
Young Sherlock Holmes.
Great film.
And I really thought he was going to be a big thing, the actor who played young Sherlock Holmes. And
I saw him in a play. It wasn't a big part.
I thought that would have been a great little...
Yeah.
Because you know he's Sherlock Holmes anyway, so they could have done... There would have been standalone things.
Yeah, it was an origin story, wasn't it, really? Because he met Watson for the first time and all of that. But no, that was a fantastic film. It would have made great sequels if they'd kept up the quality.
That was one I thought would... Because they did some really interesting things. It was the first CGI night. It was
Industrial Light and Magic, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Not the first CGI night. It was the first CGI character, I believe.
Sorry, yeah. First CGI character. I mean, same thing. But I thought it was brilliant. And I wish they'd done more of those.
Yeah, no, that's a good shout. I mean, The Matrix is the most famous example of when they sort of should have quit while they were ahead. I mean...
Jaws,
well, yeah.
I enjoyed Jaws too.
Yes.
But it's when is it, I think it's George 4, when the shark follows the plane.
It follows them on holiday.
Yeah.
And it's Michael Caine in that one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, they really just... They drive them into the ground. I mean, Jurassic Park is an example of this, I think. Like, the first one is a really good film, and the sequels have some good sequences, but they're not
devalue great. It. Yeah. Just devalue it.
Totally devalue. What would be... I'm not really for directors who were fantastically gifted and exciting in their youth running out of ideas, so revisiting their old... ideas when they get older. So you know, George Lucas famously failed at that. Ridley Scott is currently taking a long hot wee over all of his good films. I was looking at his back catalogue actually, and he had one incredible run early on and then has been hit and miss ever since,
like Coppola. Very much like Coppola.
Yeah.
I mean, Terminator 2 is probably the best. That's your best sequel. That has
James Cameron, that's different
got,
director
that's got both sides of the story, because you've got Terminator 2, amazing sequel.
Sorry, he did the first one as well. I'm thinking of Aliens.
Terminator 2, and then you've got Terminator 3 being...
Oh, trousers. Trousers. And then they panic and take it off into the future war with Terminator Salvation.
I didn't even bother watching it.
So incoherent.
It.
Yeah. It's rubbish. And then, I mean, Terminator, leave it well alone. They got too attached to Arnie, but then when they left him, they didn't know what to do with it either. They didn't create any good characters because... He's just, you know, watchable. Anyway,
well,
getting a bit rambly.
We've done... That is about 40 minutes now.
Well, this is a gift
gonna,
of an episode.
I was going to talk about another classic, but we could just... That's probably enough, isn't it?
Well, we don't want to keep people. Yeah, I mean, they've got jobs to go to.
Or, you know, yeah.
Well, Far From the Madding Crowd and a lot of letters this week. Fine. No problem at all. We will be back next week with more films.
If you want to email us, please do.
DearFilmFandango@gmail.com or go to Facebook/FilmFandango or tweet us at Mr. David Reed, at Marek Larwood or at Film Fandango. Also, despite occasional sponsorship on this, we do all of this for free. We're just trying to cover our costs. So if you'd like to contribute towards that, then please go to filmfandango.co.uk and follow the link from there. And everyone who's donated, thank you very much.
Thank you, yes.
We'll be back next week.
Keep watching the films.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. Warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.